better, bigger, and nice. So I'll be talking about a new direction for modified gravity theory that I've been exploring with my advisor, Justin Curry, who's also at the University of Pennsylvania, and Andrew Tully, who's currently at Case Western. So the first question we have to ask ourselves is why modify gravity at all? So I think at the scale of the solar system, general relativity has overcome every obstacle. Every anomaly has been resolved, including, I believe, the Pioneer anomaly recently. And I don't think there are any definitive experimental contradictions of general relativity. However, at the scale of the cosmos, the observable cosmos, I think it may be necessary to modify gravity. I'll argue why in a moment. So some of our experimental colleagues have argued quite forcefully that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. And for this, they were awarded the Nobel Prize recently. So the real question for us theorists is, what does this tell us? If the Friedman-Robertson-Walker scale factor is accelerating in its expansion, what does that mean for the nature of the universe? So we go back to the second Friedman equation up here. This is just ordinary GR, nothing fancy. And you'll notice there's a minus sign right there. So in order to get accelerating expansion, we need the pressure of the universe to be less than negative or third the energy density. So that's kind of a weird substance. The easiest way to do it is just add a cosmological constant to the action for general relativity, in which case the pressure of the cosmological constant is just negative the energy density. And in fact, the best fit, and most parsimonious fit, I should say, to the data with lambda CDM, the concordance model, is simply that, you know, dark energy, cosmological constant is about 75% of the universe, which corresponds to an energy density of about MeV to the fourth. So what's wrong with that? Nothing, right? Classically, this is fine. We don't have to worry at all. However, as soon as you introduce quantum mechanics, well, this is the famous cosmological constant problem. Our expectation from effective field theory is that the cosmological constant energy density should be of order m Planck to the fourth. And that's, well, very different from the observed apparent reality. It's off by 120 orders of magnitude. So I think the first cosmological constant problem is, why is the apparent energy density so small? So I think the best way to think about this is Weinberg wrote a review article in 1989 where he wrote down something called a no-go theorem. It wasn't really a no-go theorem, but it's called that often, which basically said it's very difficult to relax dynamically to a vanishing cosmological constant. And in fact, when you include quantum mechanical zero-point energies, in order to cancel those, just the ones from the ordinary particles in the standard model, requires a large amount of fine-tuning. And then, of course, after it was discovered that the universe was accelerating in its expansion, then the second cosmological constant problem is, why is the vacuum energy density comparable to the matter energy density today? And so some very clever people, including, I guess, Paul Steinert, among others, cooked up ways to get a dynamical dark energy which tracks the matter density so that you can have a moment when the two densities coincide. But this doesn't exactly solve the problem of the zero-point contribution, because if you modify the potentials that they used by a constant, it kind of throws off the whole thing. And more importantly, even if you did find some way to get a time of coincidence, getting that time of coincidence to be today still requires fine-tuning, as Weinberg argued. So if you agree that perhaps we need to modify general relativity because of quantum mechanics, then you'll probably know about all these different common modifications of gravity. So I won't go into the details, but there's one thing that all these common modifications have in common with each other, which is that they introduce new degrees of freedom to general relativity. So what do I mean by that? So what I mean is, of course, a field theory has infinitely many degrees of freedom, which is one of the reasons that it's a bit tricky to quantize such theories. But when I say degrees of freedom, what I really mean is local degrees of freedom, which count independent particle polarization states. So for example, a real scalar field has just one degree of freedom, local degree of freedom. A massless vector field has two. And in particular, GR has two degrees of freedom, which are the polarizations of the transverse traceless graviton. So the common modifications I was discussing before all introduce either new particles or new polarizations of particles. So for example, massive gravity introduces new vector and scalar polarizations for the graviton, which causes it to have 5 degrees of freedom instead of 2. So the question I'm posing today, and that I'll try to address in part, this is still work in progress, but we have at least one definitive result, which I'm proud of. Could general relativity be modified without new degrees of freedom? This is the question that drives the research. So another way to say it is, can we modify the behavior of the transverse traceless graviton without introducing new polarizations? So in part, this question has been answered for us already by Steven Weinberg. He has a theorem that GR is the unique Lorentz covariant theory of an interacting massless spin 2 particle. So in particular, what does this mean? This means that Lorentz covariant modifications of general relativity necessarily introduce new degrees of freedom. In particular, if you break Lorentz symmetry spontaneously, you still actually can see that you've introduced new degrees of freedom, because even in the phase where Lorentz symmetry is broken, you still have massless Goldstone bosons. So that holds, for example, with Gauss condensation. So we want to modify the behavior of the graviton, but Lorentz covariant modifications necessarily introduce new degrees of freedom. So if we want to modify the behavior of the graviton degrees of freedom without introducing new degrees of freedom, what do we have to do? Can anybody tell me? Anyone? Exactly. We have to break Lorentz covariants, and we have to do it explicitly, not spontaneously.
If it was a global symmetry, then I would have a Goldstone boson, I would know the difference. But if I have a gauge symmetry, then the Goldstone boson I can gauge away. And there's normally the statement would be that an explicitly broken theory is the same thing as a spontaneous broken theory in a specific gauge.
Actually, it's interesting you say that, because that's one of the ways that we're going to attempt to modify general relativity. But I think I'd like to know more about that. You're probably more of an expert than I am. So
it makes it sound like you're going to need, I guess the way to phrase it as a question would be, are you really going to not have any new degrees of freedom? Because it sounds like it should have been, if it spontaneously broke in the symmetry, there would be new degrees of freedom.
Okay. So if you're worried about new degrees of freedom, don't worry. We have that under control. I'll get to that. That's actually the defining attribute of our work, is there are no new degrees of freedom. So before I get to how we break Lorentz covariance without introducing new degrees of freedom, I'm just going to say a few words about breaking covariance. So depending on your philosophical background or biases, you might be for or against this kind of a modification. So I'll have to admit that general Lorentz covariance, is of course a very well-motivated assumption. We have no direct empirical violations of it. I mean, we have very good constraints coming from, supernova data, time of flight, of arrival, so forth. But the question remains, is the gravitational sector Lorentz covariant? By that I mean, if you scatter gravitons and look at the S matrix and see how it transforms under Lorentz transformations, is that a Lorentz covariant object? So that means the same trouble arises in neutrino physics, the OPERA experiment. It's very difficult to experimentally verify Lorentz covariance for these subtle, hard-to-detect particles. And even if you think it's a bad idea to break covariance, I still think it might be a good idea to know what a broken Lorentz covariance would look like cosmologically. And one more point I'll say, given the enduring mystery of dark energy, on which I don't think we have very much of a handle, it may be necessary to revisit the space-time symmetries that we build into our theories. Because after all, our universe does have a preferred frame. Now don't get me wrong, in the context of general relativity, where you have explicit Lorentz symmetry, there's a very good story for why there is a cosmic rest frame. Roughly speaking, if you have a mean rest frame in any local patch of space-time, then peculiar velocities decay. Kinetic energy in general decays like 1 over 8 to the 6th with the expansion of A. So all the peculiar velocities tend to decay, and things tend to settle down to mean rest frame. However, I still think it would be useful to be able to determine the difference, perhaps empirically, between what a spontaneously broken theory or an explicitly broken theory would look like. So with that said, we're going to be breaking a symmetry, but we're going to be doing it carefully. So we're going to relax Lorentz symmetry down to just spatial symmetry. So we're going to lose the time reparametrization symmetry. And we have to do this very carefully because, as the gentleman mentioned, if you break a symmetry, you can introduce new degrees of freedom anyway, which we don't want to do, or you could end up rendering your theory inconsistent. So to be very, very careful, we're going to use the technology of constrained field theory to analyze symmetries and count degrees of freedom. And to avoid new degrees of freedom, all we have to do, I'll just summarize this briefly, is preserve a balance between the size of phase space, the not the physical phase space, but the sort of canonical phase space, and the number of constraints that define the physical phase space within it. So I'll explain what that means in a minute. So here's the roadmap for what we're going to do. So in canonical form, GR is a theory of a spatial metric. Whoops, it's dead. Don't worry, I brought my own. GR is a theory of a spatial metric Hij, which has six components subject to four space-time gauge symmetries for a total of two degrees of freedom. Now, if we want to write down a theory of a spatial metric, Hij, which only has three gauge symmetries, the spatial ones, we're going to introduce a new graviton polarization, assuming we do it consistently in the first place. So, for example, Hojava's first paper on Hojava-Lifshitz gravity was exactly this form. I still don't know if the theory was consistent. Maybe somebody could tell me afterward. But assuming he did it right, then he would have a new degree of freedom. So what we're going to do instead is not consider theories of a spatial metric, but a unit determinant spatial metric, H tilde ij, which only has five components. So five components minus three gauge symmetries is just 2 degrees of freedom. And in fact, in a particular gauge, general relativity can be cast in exactly this form. So I think that's what you were talking about before.
Kind of, but I guess the behind this will be a question of scale. So is there, where does your theory stop? What's your ultimate argument?
That's a good question. So that's work in progress. I'll get to that toward the end, if you don't mind. Let's see. So before I get started on constrained field theory, I'm just going to talk about canonical field theory for a minute. So this is ordinary standard stuff presented in perhaps a bit non-traditional format. You start with an action, which depends on fields and their time derivatives. If you define a canonical conjugate momentum just by taking an ordinary variational derivative of the Lagrangian density, then you can write the action in canonical form. Varying the action with respect to the field gives you Hamilton's equations for the momentum. Varying with respect to the momentum gives you Hamilton's equations for the field. And that can all be summarized very nicely in this tiny equation of motion after you've defined the Poisson bracket. And the Hamiltonian, which occurs here in the equation of motion, is simply this. It's what's sitting on the right-hand side. I'm going to use this because both my lasers are dying. So the Hamiltonian that occurs in the equation of motion is simply whatever occurs on the right-hand side inside the action there. So constrained field theory is the same as canonical field theory, except that in addition to a possible physical Hamiltonian density, you have some constraints, which are enforced by Lagrange multipliers. So effectively what you have is you have your larger unphysical phase space, and then the constraints define a surface within that phase space on which the constraints vanish. So we're going to introduce the symbol twiddle or tilde or whatever to denote equality on the constraint surface, or what's called weak equality. So for example, the Hamiltonian that occurs in the equations of motion is whatever's here on the right-hand side. And on the constraint surface, the constraints vanish. So only the physical Hamiltonian density contributes to the numerical value of the Hamiltonian. So all this work of analyzing constraints was done by Dirac back in the day. So you start with some constraints, and you can split them into two groups, the first class constraints, which are called U, and the second class constraints, which are called V. So you'll notice that under the action of the Poisson bracket, the first class constraints close with some structure constants, meaning that if I take a Poisson bracket of any two first class constraints, I get some sum of other first class constraints. So these close under the Poisson bracket. If I take a Poisson bracket of first class with second class constraints, then I don't necessarily get just first class or second class constraints back, but I will get some sum of constraints, which again will vanish. And then the second class constraints, when I take their bracket, I get an antisymmetric matrix which does not vanish on the constraint surface. So to be brief, first class constraints generate gauge symmetries. You might have anticipated that because this looks like the structure constant of a gauge symmetry. And second class constraints, you can think of them as gauge fixed or gauge fixing constraints. And in general, there is a freedom to go back and forth between a theory which has only gauge symmetries and you can gauge fix it. And anyway, as we'll see, GR contains only first class constraints. So GR is a gauge theory of gravity. Are there any questions so far? No? Okay. So let's start with Maxwell theories, just as a brief example. We start with the action of electromagnetism, where the electromagnetic field strength tensor is defined here. It's very simple. We're going to do a very trivial space-time split. And you'll notice that, take my word for it, when you plug in the space-time split, only the spatial part of the vector a mu has a time derivative acting on it. So only the spatial part is dynamical. So that's the only part that gets a canonical momentum. And so when we Legendre transform to go to the Hamiltonian, we only do it with respect to the spatial part of the vector potential. And I'll notice, of course, the canonical momentum is just the electric field up to a sign. And so this is what you get for the Hamiltonian density. So now to get the canonical form of the action, I'm going to plug this back in and integrate by parts, drop the boundary term, and finally, this is what you get. This is the canonical form of the action for electromagnetism. And you'll notice that A0, not only does it not appear with time derivatives, it actually only appears here as a Lagrange multiplier, which enforces Gauss's law, which is that the divergence of the electric field has to vanish on the constrained surface. So we define the Poisson bracket here so that we can look at the constraint algebra. So we've only got one constraint, Gauss's law. It commutes with itself because pi is not conjugate to itself. So this is a first-class symmetry and generates a U1 gauge symmetry. It's very trivial, very straightforward. If we want to gauge fix the theory, we can impose a gauge fixing constraint. So here I've done radiation slash Coulomb gauge. And of course, you'll notice that A, I, is conjugate to pi I. So their Poisson bracket does not vanish on the constraint surface. So both constraints are now second class, and there's no residual gauge symmetry. Does that make sense to everybody so far? All right. Now we're going to plug in a particular nice decomposition into the metric for general relativity. So we start with the Einstein-Hilbert action with a possible cosmological constant, since it doesn't modify the number of degrees of freedom. And instead of writing it in terms of a space-time metric, we're going to plug in the ADM, or Arnowitz-Daeser-Misner decomposition, in terms of a lapse scalar, a shift vector, and a spatial metric. And now up to a boundary term, the action of general relativity simply splits into this kinetic piece and this potential piece. And you'll notice that the only thing which has time derivatives acting on it is the spatial metric. And it only enters through the extrinsic curvature tensor here. So what this means is that the lapse and the shift, n and ni, are non-dynamical. So when we do the Legendre transform, we only give a conjugate momentum to the spatial metric. And the action in canonical form, we did exactly what we did in the case of E and M, looks just like this. So as before, we have some constraints enforced by Lagrange multipliers. The lapse and the shift, in fact, do not appear anywhere in the action except here. So they're just Lagrange multipliers. They're not dynamical in any way. Of course, I've defined N0 to be the lapse. And so without going into too much detail about the exact form of the constraints, I'll just say that this constraint tells us roughly that the graviton is traceless. This H0 constraint is called the Hamiltonian constraint. And this set of three constraints, which are called the momentum constraints, tell us that the graviton is transverse. So we define the Poisson bracket once again so that we can compute the constraint algebra. So after much labor, this is all an appendix of the paper, you can find that this algebra is first class. So you notice these brackets here give a linear combination of the constraints themselves. So don't worry about the stuff in white. Only the stuff in green matters for now. This is telling you that the algebra is first class, meaning that on the constraint surface, when the constraints are have vanished, then the Poisson bracket of the constraints vanishes as well. So what is the gauge symmetry? It's a first class algebra. What's the corresponding gauge symmetry? Does anyone know?
General covariance.
Yeah, general covariance. In particular, a very special form of general covariance, These the H mu's actually generate the deformations of a space-like hypersurface embedded in a Riemannian spacetime. So if I take a point labeled by some coordinates, spatial coordinates, and I map it to another point in spacetime, then I can always decompose this transformation into components which are orthogonal to the surface. So this is like a local time direction, and this is a local spatial direction. How do I put this? So anyway, the Hamiltonian constraint generates local time translation. The momentum constraints generate local spatial diffeomorphisms. And this general covariance algebra, in fact, encodes the local Lorentz covariance of any canonical action. This was worked out by Teitelboim back in the 70s. And then later, with Kuchar and Hodgman, they proved that GR is actually the unique minimal representation of this algebra. So this complements Weinberg's theorem. Sorry?
What is that? What do you mean by a unique minimal representation?
So if you want to have ordinary canonical variables which transform as scalars under time diffeomorphisms, then GR is the smallest representation you can write down. You can write down representations which are technically smaller, but they correspond to parametrized field theories which have a non-dynamical background. So it's the unique minimal dynamical representation. In other words, if you want to write down a more complicated theory, if you want to write down a different theory which represents this algebra, you have to introduce new degrees of freedom. It's the fewest degrees of freedom corresponding to a dynamical background metric instead of a stationary background metric. Does that make sense? Right. So, in order to verify the consistency of the theory, all we have to do is check that the constraints are preserved by time evolution. So we just take the time derivative. The Hamiltonian is simply the sum of constraints. There's no physical Hamiltonian density. So when we take the time derivative, we end up having to compute the bracket of the quantity we're taking the time derivative of against the constraints. So the gauge redundancy of the theory actually enters here, because these quantities, the lapse and the shift, are not in any way constrained by the form of the action. And so in order to get rid of this redundancy, you have to gauge fix these quantities to make them particular functions. In any case, when you compute the time derivative of the constraints, you just get this bracket right here, which we already know vanishes because the constraint algebra is first class. So in particular, on the constraint surface, the time evolution, it just gives zero. So these constraints are preserved by the equation of motion. So I need some water. So now, we're going to count degrees of freedom in the canonical form of the theory. The phase space of the theory is a spatial metric, and it's conjugate momentum tensor. We have four first-class constraints, and we also have four arbitrary functions which we need to gauge fix in order to go down to the physical phase space. So we're not going to gauge fix them right away, but we're going to just use the fact that they have to be gauge fixed to count degrees of freedom. So we have six metric components, six momentum components, four constraints, four Lagrange multipliers, and that gives you a total of four canonical degrees of freedom, or we usually say two real degrees of freedom. We neglect the momentum part. So these are the polarizations of the transverse traceless graviton. And to avoid new degrees of freedom in the theory, all we have to do is preserve the balance between the size of phase space on the one hand and the number and kind of constraints on the other hand. Does that make sense to everyone? All right. Excellent. I'm going to give two examples, one that's very simple and one that is more recent, a little bit difficult for me to understand, but anyway, it's a prominent theory. So the first example I'm going to talk about is the ultralocal limit of GR, which was analyzed by Salopik back in 91 in order to study super Hubble gravitational waves. So in this limit, you neglect spatial derivatives in the action which are higher than first order. This is essentially neglecting all spatial derivatives in the Hamiltonian constraint. And so the algebra actually simplifies quite a bit. So the phase space is the same, still a spatial metric. The number of constraints is the same. It's just that the algebra is different for ultralocal gravity. So in particular, time translation is abelian, and spatial covariance is the same as it was before. This one, of course, just tells you that the Hamiltonian constraint transforms as a density of the proper weight. This is a kind of trivial. Then the other example I'm going to talk about is a little bit more prominent, more recent. So Poujava's first theory of modified gravity, as we all know, had either an additional polarization degree of freedom, or it was inconsistent. I'm not quite sure which. Maybe someone can tell me afterwards. In any case, he wanted to write down a theory which had the same basic features but did not have new degrees of freedom. So he wrote down the so-called covariant Poujava-Lifshitz gravity, which has, in fact, a larger phase space and more constraints than GR, but the motivation was to obey some form of non-relativistic covariance algebra similar to this one. So it's got a larger phase space and more constraints, but if the math all checks out, then the balance is the same. It only has 2 degrees of freedom. So if we want to modify the behavior of the graviton, I guess the ideal way to do it, from my point of view, is just to solve all the constraints. Go down to the physical phase space of the graviton degrees of freedom and modify the equations of motion there. The only trouble, of course, is that the Hamiltonian constraint is notoriously difficult to solve, and in fact, you can't solve it in general. The reason you can't is that, roughly speaking, when you examine the Hamiltonian constraint, it tells you something about the sign of the expansion of the spatial metric. So you have to take a square root, and one sign corresponds to expanding spatial metric, the other sign corresponds to a contracting spatial metric. And in general, the spatial metric can expand or contract, so you can't pick a sign in general. And I'm not an expert, but just reading Wald's textbook tells me that this is an obstacle to canonical quantum gravity. So maybe there's an expert in the audience who can tell me more about that afterwards. So our approach is motivated by cosmology. So what we're going to do is solve the Hamiltonian constraint in a cosmological gauge. This is going to reduce the size of phase space, and we're going to retain the momentum constraints. We're going to modify the ensuing spatially covariant theory. So no new degrees of freedom, but the theory will be different. So just to give you an intuition for what I'm going to talk about, because it's going to get a little bit technical, if it hasn't already, let's look at the flat FRW metric, which is controlled entirely by the FRW scale factor, which is just a function of time. So the Hubble factor is just the time derivative of the scale factor divided by the scale factor. And you can think of the phase space of the theory as simply being the scale factor and the Hubble factor. So in this little toy model, which we like a lot, the scale factor is analogous to a canonical coordinate. The Hubble factor is analogous to a canonical momentum. In particular, if you plug in the ADM decomposition, this metric corresponds to having a trivial lapse and shift. And then the spatial metric is simply controlled by the conformal part of the spatial metric, which is a function of time. So I'm going to argue that this quantity, the volume factor of the spatial metric, which is the square root of the determinant of the spatial metric, is sort of a, you'll see in a more precise way in a moment, the volume factor here is conjugate to the trace of the momentum tensor. So in other words, the conformal part of the spatial metric is conjugate to the trace of the momentum tensor. Does that make sense so far? OK. So more precisely, we're going to split the spatial metric into a volume factor, which I'll call omega, little omega, and a unit determinant metric, h twiddle. So the decomposition is right here. We chose the volume factor instead of just the conformal part because this makes its corresponding conjugate momentum a scalar, a three-scalar, just a technical detail. So anyway, after you've split the metric into its unit determinant part and its conformal part, you can split the phase space correspondingly into the conformal part and the unit determinant part. So the conformal part of the metric, this volume factor here, is exactly conjugate to the trace of the momentum tensor up to a factor. And the other part of the phase space is simply defined by the condition that the determinant here is just one, and in particular, the conjugate momentum to it is traceless. So this decomposition I've written down is completely general, and we've sort of split phase space into the conformal part and the unit determinant part. Good? Okay. So now we're going to impose cosmological gauge. So I'm going to make a little running tally here on the side of degrees of freedom. Okay. So we started with a spatial metric. It's conjugate momentum tensor. We had four constraints. Four Lagrange multipliers. Now we're going to impose cosmological gauge. So this is 6 plus 6. I'll get to that in a second. I just want to summarize GR first. 4, it's 4. Okay. So in cosmological gauge, we're going to use the conformal part of the metric as our clock. Essentially, we're going to, in an analogy to the FRW metric, we're going to take the conformal part of the spatial metric to be our definition of time. And this is, of course, valid. It's not valid in general, because sometimes the conformal part of the metric can contract. But about an FRW background, this is valid. You can impose this consistently. So technically what you do is you define a new gauge fixing constraint, which takes the dynamical omega and sets it equal to a function of time. You impose it in the action of the Lagrange multiplier lambda. And in particular, we have chosen this constraint that we've defined to have a non-vanishing Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian constraint. So now both of these constraints are second class. This allows us to solve for their Lagrange multipliers. And so what we're going to do is, once again, we have the same number of canonical variables. We're going to add an additional constraint. So we've got H0, the Hamiltonian constraint, and chi, and the momentum constraints. So that's 5 constraints. But some of the Lagrange multipliers we can actually solve for. So we've actually only got 3 arbitrary functions. So let's go over it right here really quickly. So we've got the same phase space. We have an additional constraint here, but it allows us to solve for one of our original arbitrary functions and for the new Lagrange multiplier. So we have 5 constraints, but only 3 arbitrary functions. So the counting is exactly the same. Does that make sense to everybody? Maybe that went by a little quickly. So we're going to impose a new gauge fixing constraint, which has a non-vanishing bracket with the Hamiltonian constraint. This means that both of these constraints are in a second class, and this fact allows us to solve for the Lagrange multipliers, so they're no longer arbitrary functions. So relative to ordinary GR, we added a new constraint and a new arbitrary function, but because these two are second class with each other, we can solve for their Lagrange multipliers. So in fact, only 3 of the functions are arbitrary. Counting is the same.
So
question.
So the constraint chi is 0, you're basically saying you're an FRW gauge where you've evolved the spatial part of the metric as a function of time.
That's right.
So essentially, so is it right that we just think chi is 0, it's just saying you're an FRW background?
Basically, yes.
Yeah.
We're doing this about an FRW background.
There's no more scale factor, x squared t multiplies on spatial.
That's exactly right. Okay. So does that make sense what I've said so far?
So if, say, I have homogeneous FRW, just FRW, and I have 1 degree of freedom, what's your scalar field and its conjugate?
I don't know if I would think of it that way. So in the homogeneous case, we actually only have functions of time. So they're not functions of space. So if there are degrees of freedom, they're like discrete degrees of freedom.
Yeah, as I was talking about like, the matter degrees of freedom. So he's talking about just the GR.
I'm saying if I take, so basically it sort of sounds to me that if I take the volume factor to be the pure dynamical time, so then you don't have another degree of freedom, right?
That's right. We haven't introduced any degrees of freedom.
FRW by itself doesn't have any degree of freedom left.
Right. So we're just writing GR in a gauge that is particularly conducive to our purpose. All right. So after rewriting the Hamiltonian constraint in terms of our decomposition, you find that the constraint is quadratic in the trace part of the momentum tensor. So by taking a square root, we can solve the constraint to obtain an actual value for the trace of the momentum tensor. We had to pick a sign, which corresponds to an expanding universe here. And this function is pretty simple. We just have the kinetic part for the graviton and the potential part for the graviton sitting together inside a square root. So it's quite similar to relativistic point particles, something like that. So in particular, what we've done is we began with a theory of a spatial metric and a momentum tensor. We modded out by these two second-class symmetries. Then by solving this constraint, we have actually eliminated the conformal part of the phase space. So remember, omega is now just a function of time. Pi omega is now a function of these phase space variables and their spatial derivatives. And so we have reduced the size of phase space.
But we should be less general theory than general theory.
Well,
this kind of zero is something that works now.
But it's just a gauge fixing of GR.
Yeah.
So you couldn't do this for a short term metric, for example.
That's exactly right. So So essentially what we're doing, classically, this is a perfectly valid procedure. Maybe quantum mechanically you have to sum over all histories so things break down, but classically, we can just consider a certain subset of possible solutions to GR for which this gauge is well defined. So really, for the class of backgrounds we're talking about, this is just GR in a special gauge.
So that's confusing me a little bit. So but you're not just doing GR in a particular gauge, right? You're gonna
eventually going to modify it.
But I haven't
modified it yet. This is just a gauge choice. So general relativity, written in spatially covariant gauge, looks just like this. So we have the piece of the action, which generates Hamilton's equations. We have our constraints, the momentum constraints, which have this particular form. And then we have a physical Hamiltonian density, which occurs here, and then here in the Hamiltonian. So pi omega is just equal to the function I showed you before, the square root, with the kinetic and potential inside of it. As before, we have Lagrange multipliers enforcing these three constraints. And we have to modify our definition of the Poisson bracket just a little bit, but aside from that, things are pretty straightforward. So now, the phase space of the theory is smaller. Let's go over here. I don't know if everybody can see this. But we now only have a unit determinant metric. Oops, I'll write the 5 over here. And a traceless momentum tensor. Subject to three momentum constraints and it has three arbitrary functions sitting inside it. So the phase space is smaller. We have fewer first class constraints, fewer arbitrary functions, but the same number of canonical degrees of freedom. So when we modify gravity, we're going to rely on the fact that this counting depends solely and entirely on the size of the phase space and the first class constraint structure. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. Now, our ansatz for modifying gravity is simply to modify the physical Hamiltonian density on the reduced phase space of the unit determinant metric and the traceless momentum tensor. We're going to be focusing on the scalar part of the physical Hamiltonian density, which is pi omega. And to represent spatial covariance and keep the number of degrees of freedom the same, we're going to demand two conditions. So the momentum constraints have to remain first class, and they have to remain consistent with the equations of motion. And of course, spatially covariant GR satisfies both. It's tedious to verify, but it's true. So now the question is, what freedom is there to modify this function, pi omega, which is the scalar part of the physical Hamiltonian density? So I mean, given the symmetries of our theory, there's a lot of freedom to write things down. It's very difficult to check that the algebra is consistent and that the equations of motion are consistent with the constraints. So we're going to do a gradient expansion, because we're doing cosmology. Spatial derivatives are not as important in cosmology as they are in other contexts. So we're going to expand in powers of the covariant spatial derivative with respect to the unit determinant metric, which I call grad twiddle. So you can think of pi omega as being, there's a piece which has no derivatives in it, there's a piece which has one derivative in it, and there's a piece that has two derivatives in it, and so forth and so on. So because we're not coupling to matter, there actually are no vector quantities in this theory whatsoever, aside from the momentum constraints, which vanish, of course. So pi 1 vanishes identically. So if we take only the lowest order, the two lowest order terms, we get what's called an ultra-local theory of gravity. So I'm going to neglect this for just the time being. So essentially what we're doing, we're taking the lowest order term in the gradient expansion. We're going to assume that our pi omega contains no spatial derivatives whatsoever. This is a long wavelength, a very deep infrared approximation, similar to what Salopik did with his analysis of gravitational waves. So you can think of this as being a theory only of the kinetic part of the graviton. I showed you before that inside the square root, there was a piece that depended on pi twiddle traced against itself, and there was a potential piece. We're only going to be thinking about the kinetic pieces. We're going to preserve the form of the momentum constraints. And given our onsets here, with no spatial derivatives, the most general function we can write down will depend on time and the scalars, which are called phi n, which are essentially a contraction of the pi's against themselves in sort of a loop. So you put n factors of pi twiddle next to each other, and you contract each one with its neighbor, and then you loop back around. So that's the most general set of scalars you can write down in this theory. Does everybody follow so far? Good. Okay. Now, computing the algebra, making sure that the algebra remains first class, is a bit tricky, because even though we've neglected derivatives in pi omega, we still have derivatives inside the Hamiltonian constraint. So we're going to split the Hamiltonian constraint into a tensor part and a scalar part. And to compute the Poisson brackets, we're going to rely on a trick called the smoothing functional. So the algebra I showed you before has factors of the Dirac delta function sitting in it. The Dirac delta function is not defined in a pointwise manner, because delta of anything other than 0 is 0, and delta of 0 is infinity. So the Dirac delta function is only defined by what it does when it's integrated against some ordinary function, which is not divergent, not infinite anywhere. So what we'll do is we'll define these smoothing functionals, where we integrate an arbitrary smoothing function against these two components of the Hamiltonian, of the momentum constraints. And we're going to take the Poisson brackets of these functionals and use them to derive distributional identities, that is, identities which hold for any sensible smoothing functions. So here's a sample. If we take the tensor part of the momentum constraints, we can take their bracket in a formal sense, and we see that the bracket of Fj with Gj has this bracket of the j's sitting in it. We can also take an explicit variational derivative of the smoothing functionals. And when we plug this, these two expressions, into the definition of the Poisson bracket, we get a rather complicated expression. But if you finesse it, integrate by parts, move things around, you can rewrite it in this form. And just by comparing what's sitting next to the smoothing functions, you can see that in a distributional sense, the Poisson bracket of the tensor part of the momentum constraints is just this. So this is exactly the same as the momentum algebra in GR. It's pretty straightforward. This won't change when we modify gravity. So because the scalar part has just an ultra-local pi omega sitting inside it, it's actually quite easy to do the Poisson bracket here. So this is the final result for the Poisson brackets of the j's with the k's, the tensor part with the scalar part. And at the end of it, you get that the brackets between the momentum constraints have exactly the form they did in GR. So that's great. It's first class, so it consistently represents spatial covariance. So now we have to check the consistency of these constraints. Essentially, all we have to do is take their time derivative. It's a little trickier now because we have a physical Hamiltonian density. So we can't just rely on a constraint algebra. We have to take a Poisson bracket with the physical Hamiltonian density. But because we have such a simple form for pi omega, It just depends on these scalars, phi of n, and possibly time. We can get a simple answer here. Now, to get this simple form, we assume that omega, of course, is an invertible function of time. So we can take derivatives with respect to omega instead of with respect to time. And here's the answer, after doing all the work, where we've defined this operator delta right here. So it's omega d d omega. And then you have an infinite series of derivatives with respect to the phi scalars. And now this contribution to the time derivative of the momentum constraint vanishes because the constraints are first class. This piece here is the only piece that could be non-zero. We need it to be zero. So after doing a little bit of work, you can show that the necessary and sufficient condition for the constraints to be consistent with the equations of motion, that is for their time derivative to vanish, we require this quantity right here to be exactly zero. So this is a conformal RG equation. If you've done field theory, just think of that as a mu d mu, and then you'll see that this condition is telling you that you need conformal invariance. In other words, the overall amplitude of the scale can't matter. So the easiest way to see that is to do a conformal scaling of the spatial coordinates by some factor lambda. And the conformal, this sort of volume factor here, scales like lambda to the 3. And the trace of the, so I just pulled one index down to make this very simple. So the conformal part, the volume part of the metric scales like lambda cubed there. The traceless momentum tensor scales like lambda cubed there. So the invariant scalars, we have to take the ratio. We have to put phi of n on top and omega to the n on the bottom, because of course we have n factors of the traceless momentum tensor sitting inside phi. So the most general solution to our... Sorry?
Where does phi appear? Is it in your action somewhere? Or
no, we're just making pi omega a function of these phis. So pi omega appears in the action in the physical Hamiltonian density and in the momentum constraint. And we're going to make this an arbitrary function of the traceless momentum tensor. And the most arbitrary...
So you're adding a constraint?
No, the constraints are exactly the same. We're just changing the functional form of pi omega.
So what is the functional form of pi omega in GR?
So in GR, the functional form is the square root.
OK, so this is the Hamiltonian constraint. So you're changing the Hamiltonian constraint.
Sort of. So we solved the Hamiltonian constraint.
Yeah.
And this gives us a concrete functional form for pi omega.
Yeah, but so you are just adding that phi n to that equation in the box of the Hamiltonian equation.
Not exactly. I think maybe we can talk about this.
I'm generalizing the pi omega to be a function not only pi j, but pi j.
Right. So instead of just having this pi j squared piece, we can have pi j cubed, or to the fourth, et cetera. So we're neglecting all the potential terms.
Since that equation came from the equation above, didn't it come from the equation above?
Right. So in other words, we solved the Hamiltonian constraint, plugged the result back into the action, and the Hamiltonian constraint drops out. So now we have a physical Hamiltonian density sitting here, and three momentum constraints sitting here. And of course, the physical Hamiltonian density appears inside the momentum constraint. So we don't have a Hamiltonian constraint anymore. We just have the three momentum constraints. And the way we're modifying gravity is simply to change the functional form of the physical Hamiltonian density, which appears here in the action and here in the constraints. So given that pi omega is just a function of these phi n's, we found that in order for the time derivative of the momentum constraint to vanish, the physical Hamiltonian density has to obey this conformal RG equation. And it's very easy to do this. All we have to do is pi omega can have an arbitrary dependence on pi twiddle. But it just has to be balanced by this conformal factor to an appropriate power. So to satisfy the conformal energy equation, all we have to do is make pi omega an arbitrary function of these invariant scalars. So you can have pi ij squared, cubed, all the way up, as much as you want. Is that clear to everybody so far?
Is it fair to say that G here is just pi omega of pi quid 2 and now something higher?
More or less. So it only depends on phi bar 2, but then it also has dependence on the Ricci scalar of the unit determinant metric.
But if you get rid of that metric, wasn't that the ultra-local part?
Right, so we've gotten rid of we've done the ultra-local limit, so yeah, sure. The ultra-local version of GR would just depend on this. Okay, so summary of the consistency conditions. What we found is that the ultra-local Hamiltonian must obey this conformal RG equation, which encodes the invariance of the theory under flow through the space of conformally equivalent spatial metrics. If you haven't followed the technical part, you can just recall that the FRW scale factor has a scale invariance in it. In other words, the first Friedman equation only depends on A dot over A. So if you rescale A by some constant, the theory is not changed. That sort of conformal invariance of the spatial part of the metric must remain in the theories we're considering. And that's it. So in terms of ultra-local theories of gravity, anything that obeys this equation is valid. There are no other restrictions. So. So
you're not going to go to adding the Ricci scalar?
I will.
Are you allowed?
Yeah. Well, it just depends on time and interest. So the temporary conclusions are, so I think I've argued that we can, in fact, modify the behavior of the graviton without new degrees of freedom just by preserving a careful balance between the number of constraints on the one hand and the size of phase space on the other. We can write GR in a manifestly spatially covariant form, and we've shown that we can modify the physical Hamiltonian density that occurs.
Is there a quantum part of that story?
Quantum part?
Yeah.
Well, not yet, no. We haven't done any of that. That'll be something for later. I haven't thought about that very much. So, general relativity is therefore not the unique theory of a transverse traceless graviton. And we've demonstrated it in this ultra-local limit. Now, if there's time and interest, since my hour is almost up.
If I was wondering, say, what's unique theory about any background, this is an extension of GR that only works around certain background material. You could your gauge choice of background material isn't a general quantum metric.
That's right.
So if we pick a particular class of background, Mm-hmm.
That's right. I imagine it would be more complicated to extend this to more backgrounds.
Yeah.
So a background independent version of this would be, I guess, pretty tricky.
Yeah.
I've thought a little bit about how to do that, but I haven't gotten very far.
Yeah, but the conclusion is actually not correct, right? So this is not GR, it's just this part of GR.
Yeah, this is an effective theory, not a certain background.
That's exactly right. It's good that you mentioned effective theory, because that'll bring us to our next point if there's time and interest. So, we want to UV complete our ultra-local theory.
Before you dive into that.
Oh.
Since you mentioned effective theories, and you promised earlier on to come back to the issue of how high your scale was going to be, how high will your scale be?
So we're not quite sure. We're in the process now of looking at UV completions of the theory. So, if I had to guess, for example, I would guess that the scale has something to do with Hubble and M. Planck, just off the top of my head, but we don't have any concrete results in that direction.
But right now it's just Hubble, right? So you only have your
Hubble's the only scale we have in our theory.
Because your motivation was the cosmological constant problem, right? And that's,
well, I think, so what I argue is that the cosmological constant problem and the coincidence problem are very strong motivations to think about modifying gravity. I'm not going to claim to have solved those at all, but so one possible way the people have thought about solving that problem is to consider unimodular theories of gravity, where you take the space-time metric and you peel off the conformal factor and make that non-dynamical in a certain way. And this is kind of similar, because there's new chalk. So so the square root of minus g is equal to n square root h And so the way we've written the theory, you see that the lapse n is non-dynamical, and we've made this just a function of time. And so one way to think about the cosmological constant problem is that you have an arbitrary constant coupling to the conformal part of the spacetime metric here. And so in the, I guess, I think Teitelbaum thought about this, in the theories of unimodular gravity, you say that this conformal part of the spacetime metric is non-dynamical. And that was maybe perhaps one ingredient that led to our approach here, is that when you write down the theory in our language, the conformal part of the spacetime metric isn't dynamical. However, of course, the obvious caveat is we haven't coupled anything to matter yet. So I'm not going to claim that we solved the cosmological constant problem or anything like that. I was just trying to make the case that it could be a good idea to consider modifying general relativity in light of these problems.
It's true that until you get to the quantum side of the issue, not just for the cosmological constant problem, most of the power of the constraints that say that it's a unique thing are coming from the interplay between quantum mechanics and relativity, right? So it's, if you don't do the quantum mechanics side of it, it's
Well, so there's a sense in which we've already done all the quantum mechanics except for the loops, right? Because the, so if you do field theory.
What's the quantum mechanics of the loops?
Well, okay, so if you look at the, like the Green's functions of classical field theory, then essentially what you're doing is all the tree diagrams, you're not doing the loops. So there's a sense in which we've done quantum mechanics already just by doing this constraint analysis. We've just neglected all graviton loops.
I would have said the tree diagrams is the classical theory.
That's right.
Classical theory.
Okay. Okay, so we've done just the classical theory, or the quantum theory with no loops.
The H bar equals zero limit.
Exactly.
So I think another way to do this to get gravity without any degrees of freedom is a thing that Izol and I did before, called Coskuton metric. You heard of it?
Called what?
The Coskuton. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I think it's very similar to what you have, but instead of adding these phi functions, you add an arbitrary function of pi omega.
So
you could actually
read
this.
No, but it's
well,
not dynamical because.
So yeah. I don't know exactly the language correspondence between our approach and your approach, but what I recall is that you added a non-dynamical scalar field, it had like a infinite sound speed, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's right. So it is not. But so that's the point. So it doesn't have a dynamical degree of freedom. So the counting would go this way, and I think in your language it would just be instead of working the powers of phi tilde, you could just have some arbitrary function of pi omega to your Hamiltonian. So that means, we can discuss about the details, but that's not.
I'm sure there's a correspondence. It's the same basic idea is, you have a background which has no new degrees of freedom. And in your case, I guess it would be defined by a non-dynamical scalar field, something like that. So again, if there's time and interest, I can go on to the UV completion of our theory, which isn't finished, but we have some preliminary results which are kind of interesting. So, doing the second order term in the gradient expansion is very, very difficult. That's not done. Because, in other words, you have to define you get an infinite series of multiple different types of scalars that involve the Ricci tensor contracted against arbitrary functions of pi, and you can include two derivatives acting on pi itself. So it gets really complicated. What we have finished is we have finished a case where pi omega depends on spatial derivatives only through the Ricci scalar of the unit determinant metric. So one reason to think this is kind of an interesting limit is that just as with GR, the Ricci scalar of the spacetime metric is the leading term you write down in your action, correspondingly, you can think of dependence on this Ricci scalar as the leading local correction to the infrared dynamics that we've considered. So in that case, we're going to consider pi omegas, which are an arbitrary function of these kinetic scalars, which are contractions of pi against itself, the traceless pi against itself. And then they can depend also on time or the Ricci scalar of the unit determinant metric. And in particular, this class of theories includes GR. We just have phi of 2 sitting there. And we've got R twiddle sitting there.
Do you have any observational consequence of this phi of 3s?
Well, not yet. But in principle, we should be able to evade all constraints because GR is a special case of the theory. So if we were to modify this parametrically, we could just tune the parameters.
Yeah, you said all the rest of the
Yeah.
Thanks.
So I think you could tune the parametric modifications, but so we haven't gotten quite there yet, and you'll see why in a second. So the in the realistic case, where we allow a dependence on the Ricci scalar, assuming that the constraints are first class, which I'll get to in a minute, just imposing this consistency with the equations of motion tells you that you need to satisfy a modified RG equation. So it's the same as before, except we have a new factor, which includes the scaling of the Ricci scalar, of the unit determinant metric. So the easiest way to see where this vector of 2/3 comes from is if you scale the omega, the volume factor, by some constant, the unit determinant metric doesn't change at all, but the derivatives inside the Ricci scalar do pick up a couple of factors of mu, and it's to the 2/3 power here. So the invariant scalars are the ones we had before, where you had 5n over omega to the n, so the 5 bars of n. And then we have r bar, which is our twiddle over omega to the 2/3. So the most general solution, which solves this conformal RG equation, is a function of r bar and the 5 bar. So this is not very different from what we had before. Where it gets tricky is that, well, the Poisson brackets for computing the algebra are much more difficult. So the tensor part of this constraint is the same as before. The j's don't depend on pi omega, so their bracket remains exactly the same. However, the Poisson brackets, which involve the k's, which depend on gradients of pi omega, are much more difficult because you have two powers of the derivatives acting on the variation of the field. So to compute these brackets, we resort, of course, to smoothing functionals. So this is a sample bracket. We take smoothing function with the k's, with the j's, and we take the bracket. It's very complicated. It takes a long time for this to simplify. And this is the best you get. So this is more or less what we had before. We took the bracket of the j's with the k's, and we get something that looks like this. But now we have all these new boundary terms generated by those two gradients I showed you before. So the realistic algebra, we take the bracket of the momentum constraints, plug in the answers, we get this piece. These two terms are the same as before. And now we have this new piece, which looks pretty complicated, but it actually only depends on this vector quantity here, ik, which itself is a little bit complicated, but it only has three terms. So you can argue that as we do in the paper, that the necessary and sufficient condition for this bracket to vanish on the constraint surface is for the ik vector to vanish on the constraint surface. So in the ultra-local case, it's trivial. It's zero because the dependence on the Ricci scalar is zero. So this vanishes, and this vanishes in the ultra-local case. In the case of spatially covariant GR, actually, it's not completely trivial. The ik vector is exactly proportional to the constraints. And I'll show you in a second, it's highly not trivial. You start with the definition of the ik vector, plug in the form of pi gr, and the terms sort of magically cancel one by one until you get the two pieces of the momentum constraint. And finally, the ik vector is proportional to the constraints. So this relied on a number of very special cancellations. So we have determined that there are two necessary and sufficient conditions for this realistic case to be consistent. So we have to satisfy the conformal RG equation, and we have to satisfy the vanishing of this vector, this new differential condition. But we haven't classified all the solutions to this equation, to this condition, rather. We know that general relativity is one, but it's not clear at the moment whether you can actually modify GR parametrically in infrared. So current work, future work, is to classify solutions to the differential condition and generalize the results to include a more general dependence of pi omega on derivative quantities. So the reason I think this is interesting is that either way we answer this question will be fruitful. So I'll get to that in a second. So once again, we can modify the behavior of the graviton without any degrees of freedom. We've done it in the ultra-local limit. In the realistic case, it's actually not clear if we can modify GR parametrically. So if we can, we'll have a new class of modified gravity theories to look at. If we can't, it might be that GR is the unique, low-energy, local theory of the graviton degrees of freedom. And when I say local, I mean in the sense that the energy density depends on spatial derivatives. So in the ultra-local case, there were no spatial derivatives. And so there's a sense in which each space-time point is evolving independently of all the others. As soon as you introduce a local coupling in the energy density, it gets very much more complicated to consistently couple adjacent space-time points to each other. So if it turns out that GR is the unique low-energy local realistic theory of the graviton degrees of freedom, in other words, it's the unique theory that has this Ricci scalar dependence, then it could be that Lorentz invariance in the gravitational sector could arise as an accidental symmetry instead of being a fundamental symmetry. So I think that's it. Any questions? I'll be here tomorrow and Thursday in room 334.
Actually, I just wanted to comment on what Chris was saying before.
I'm
not going to comment. I guess the point is that this is you're explicitly breaking Lorentz invariance, but you can covariantize this theory by any theory you give me, I can covariantize it by introducing the format you can.
That's a good point. You can always
By introducing just the metric and general coordinate transformation, right? I can just say that this is a theory in a particular coordinate system. It uses a general coordinate transformation and a four metric and then covariance.
That's a very good point. In fact, in the sense of having some sort of coordinate symmetry, in the sense you described, it's always possible to covariantize a theory. However, the theory that you'll end up with will be basically a parametric field theory on a sort of a non-dynamical background. The special covariance algebra of GR encodes local Lorentz covariance in addition to just an arbitrariness of coordinate transformations. So if you want local Lorentz covariance along with this general covariance, then GR is the unique minimal theory. So modifications that have that local Lorentz covariance will introduce new degrees of freedom. But it's always possible to, so this was Dirac's starting point, actually, was he started with field theories in Minkowski space, introduced arbitrary coordinates, and found that the exact algebra, see if I can bring it up again.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. The problem is you're already in these super horizon limits. You don't really know what the theory looks like in the UV.
That's exactly right. So just one second. So this algebra actually does arise, how do I put this? In a locally Lorentz covariant theory, the general covariance you get is exactly this form. The sort of sense in which you can always introduce general covariance will not always give you this special algebra. So then what you're saying about, right, so we haven't UV completed the theory. So we don't know yet if it's possible to parametrically modify GR. However, I think I've argued that it's actually kind of interesting either way. So if we can modify GR parametrically, then we can look for theories of gravity where the graviton behaves differently at large distances without new degrees of freedom. So for example, in massive gravity theories, you say, OK, maybe the mass of the graviton is of order Hubble. And then you would expect gravity to behave differently at these large distances. But then you have to introduce new polarizations, which we haven't found yet. And there is actually a consistent story involving the Weinstein mechanism and screening mechanisms to explain why we haven't seen those degrees of freedom. But it still remains the case that we haven't seen those degrees of freedom, even though people have been looking. So in our case, what we're trying to do is preserve just the spatial covariance, modify GR parametrically away from the infrared toward the UV. And if we can do it, we'll have an instance where, so for example, if you had dependence on pi twiddle cubed, you could imagine having a sort of a runaway behavior. You get like a graviton condensate where the energy density could grow preferentially in one direction, which could possibly lead to self-acceleration, something like that, without new degrees of freedom, just by breaking the Lorentz covariance. And then if it turns out that we can't do that consistently, then what we have derived is that you can start with a theory of a unit determinant metric, which is a spatially covariant theory. And then as soon as you introduce any local dependence In other words, any local coupling between adjacent spacetime points, GR pops out. It's like the unique consistent theory. So I think either way, it's quite interesting.
But that was what happened in Kaskutan, that is, and as far as you just get GR, but then only this ultra-local limit you get modification. About in the super horizon schedule, you get modifications of GR. So but it's not, it doesn't happen suddenly, but it's just a gradual thing, that if you go to super horizon limit, then it's a different theory, but if you go to sub horizon limit, it's just GR.
Isn't this what touch point was showing all along?
I think so. Yeah, I think that's the point. That it's if I think that the Weinberg's theorem it's only applies to estimate this or something. Isn't that
right. Well, so Dazier had a. Let me go back to that bit. Let's see.
So if
the
you are
archive
in asymptotically flat space time or in this Minkowski limit, then.
Right. So Dazier has a nicer proof. Feynman has a more, I guess, pedagogical approach in his lectures on gravitation. Right, I think this one just takes, you know, you start with A to mu nu, and you have just an arbitrary theory of some tensor field, and then I think it's about a flat background, and as soon as you make it an interacting theory, then you sort of, GR just pops out. So that's not actually, so I think Weinberg's case is an S matrix proof, and then Dazier's case is just a field theory proof.
So what is the loophole which you use to avoid this theorem?
Well, we broke Lorentz covariance. That's the loophole.
Lorentz covariance.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. If you keep Lorentz covariance and you want to modify gravity, So you could write down like a complex scalar field or something that has 2 degrees of freedom, but that's not exactly a modification of GR. If you want to write down a Lorentz covariant theory, which is a modification of GR, then seems like you have to introduce new degrees of freedom. So we relax the gravitational gauge symmetry from Lorentz space-time symmetry down to spatial symmetry. We correspondingly reduce the number of dynamical variables. And then, yeah, that's the loophole.
You both went to choice background, which basically
that's exactly right. Mm-hmm.
And on the background front, can you clarify exactly what background you need? I mean, obviously, you need something that's even monotonically expanded.
That's right. That's right.
You need something that's homogeneous.
Yeah, right.
And
to a good approximation.
And then do you also need flat? You mentioned how your conformal is related to the ability.
You don't need flat. I mean, you could have some curvature because the unit determinant part of the metric in. So if you look at a flat or an open or a closed universe, the unit determinant metric will either be correspond to, let's see, depending on, so the unit determinant metric will just be, you know, the Kronecker delta in the flat case. And then in the open and closed case, it'll have some square roots sitting inside of it, which cause the overall determinant of that piece to be 1, but then encode the fact that the universe is either has positive or negative curvature. So you don't need flatness.
Sorry, are you modifying the theory for closed universe then, you're saying?
So we haven't made any assumptions about open, closed, or whatever.
But you said determinant 1, and I don't know if you can do that in a closed. How can you do that in a closed?
Why wouldn't you be able to do that? I think you can always take the determinant of the metric, just peel off the conformal factor.
I thought you put the constraint that the determinant of Hij is 1, but then you.
So what I did was, go to my roadmap. Here we go. So what we did was we peeled off the conformal part and made it a function of time. And we're only considering theories of a unit determinant spatial metric, which has 5 components. So we're not restricting the determinant of this to be 1. We're saying the determinant of this is a function of time. And then this is the dynamical part.
So that could be a closed universe.
Yeah, so this could be closed or open or flat or what have you.
But closed might turn around and start contributing and have a giddy problems. It's not the
maybe.
Global
So we haven't coupled anything to matter or looked at like the Friedman equation in Jordan frame or anything like that. So I can't tell you more concrete details like this.
Oh, and then you have to try to close this.
Right.